principle of income from sense. He has autonomy over his choices in these cases.
Okay, does anybody else have a different take on what Paul Applebaum said about that, or is that the consensus consensus in terms of the summary of what was stated last week? And I'm just curious, because different people can filter things differently.
Lucid might not be. You might be lucid, but still have some sort of irrational reasoning. So that Paul Applebaum did explain that there was
Well, no, the incompetence exception is just the question. The question is, what is
lucid,
that?
Well, lucid might just be that he's thinking at his best, ability, but that doesn't mean that he's thinking rationally or something.
Good.
Okay.
We can compel patients to act rationally.
And then it just depends on how you define rational.
I don't think the issue is whether you can compel patients to act rationally, because I think you're right, you can't compel patients to act rationally. But the question is, do we have to respond to a patient's request or refusal if it is irrational? So I think there's an important distinction there. Yes,
there's
tell
no
me your name. So you're...
Yes.
Okay.
There's nothing that says that his request was irrational or based on anything rational. And I didn't think that they regarded him as an incompetent so that they could get permission for the heart transplant.
Okay, good.
So they had good intentions, but they approved of either the one thing or the one thing.
Okay, so what you're saying then is it seems that he really was rational from what it seems like in the case, and therefore the doctors were wrong to go and ask his wife to get consent to do the surgery. And they should have, not as accurately as what you intended, the doctors should have respected his refusal and not proceeded with a heart transplant. I'm sorry, you say it seems as if that okay, good. I hope everybody heard that. So that the idea that the patient's expression of refusal in the setting of knowing that he's going to die as a competency, which is what I'm assuming that Paul probably used most of the time. Competency is a legal term. And in the medical or clinical setting, we usually refer to it as the capacity to make a decision, whether or not someone has that capacity or not. There's really not a whole lot of difference between the two, and I think you can use them interchangeably for the purposes of our competition here. Yes, tell me your name.
Good morning. I would also just add on the question of whether his wife had an independent legal right to make the decision.
Okay, so why is that relevant? Tell me when that becomes relevant.
Well, if, as I understand it, so I don't have any legal background, but I imagine that it's possible that she actually had power of attorney prior to this, in which case his refusal would have had no legal implications.
So what you're referring to is what we call invoking a surrogate decision maker. In different states, it's referred to differently. In some cases, it's called a power of attorney. In the state of Massachusetts, it's actually a healthcare proxy. And a power of attorney can be sometimes a little bit broader than that in terms of responsibility for not just medical issues, but also financial issues also. But the point is still basically the same, that what you're saying is that there's turning to someone else, maybe his wife, who has responsibility for making decisions on his behalf. The important point to recognize about that is that a healthcare proxy or a person who has a power of attorney that includes healthcare is only comes into play when a person does not have the capacity to make decisions. So it goes back to your question, which is, well, if this person was lucid, did he then have can we draw a conclusion from this, the context and the statement in the case about him being lucid to a statement about him having the capacity to make decisions? And if he did indeed have the capacity to make decisions, then there is really no role for a healthcare proxy's opinion. Now, I should just because I sense that my task is to bring you a sense of the clinical reality. In practice, families, spouse, children, always have a tremendous role in these kinds of conversations. So in practice, even if someone who is formally appointed a healthcare proxy, and that's usually done in advance of a patient having an acute illness, their opinions, whereas their opinions may not be determinative in terms of what's done, there's still a conversation between those family members, the spouse, the children, other relatives, and that's also a very cultural thing. In different cultures, different decisions are made differently in terms of family involvement versus the individual involvement. We happen to live in the United States in American culture is one that is very focused on the individual, on patient autonomy, on the individual patient making decisions for him or herself. In many other cultures, that's not the case. And if you look at especially South American cultures, you have families that make decisions. And I would say even in some Jewish settings, that's probably the case also. There's much more a wider spectrum of decision making.
Two things. First thing is, it seems legal mechanism to use here to meet the proxy. The minute he basically makes a suicide alert, they decide who's irrational and go to the proxy. So it's not, I don't think that's so difficult.
So what are you saying though? Is that okay or it's not okay?
Well, I want to question their motives in doing that. Because it's not, somebody mentioned before that it seems that they wanted to save the life of the patient. Perhaps they were also put under tremendous pressure because that heart did arrive in 3 days. I mean, that's not. It's not such a. I don't know how common it is for a heart to arrive. 3 days. The guy was on the list.
Right.
So they're under tremendous pressure to get that heart into the patient, and it was a big surprise for them, for the person to say, actually no.
Okay, so let's take that issue because I think it's one of the central issues on this. I put down a series of questions that I hope we'll go through, but you're really raising a question that I think points to the third question that I have written down there, which is. Can someone actually have the capacity to consent to a treatment, but not to refuse a treatment? And I hope that the question is clear. In other words, if he had said, yeah, go ahead and put the heart in, I don't think anybody would have questioned his lucidity, his capacity to make decisions. However, the minute, as you're saying, he's making a decision that seems what we would say. So let's just take that point for a second, and I hope everybody heard it and understood it. And let me just ask you, is it the decision itself that we should be focused on? Is it the patient's decision to refuse the transplant that should determine whether or not we accept his wishes or not, respect his wishes or not?
No, I'm saying a decision to refuse a treatment cannot be an invalid decision or else informed consent is meaningless.
No, but my question is, can you envision a situation where someone actually has the capacity to consent to a treatment but does not have the capacity to refuse treatment?
No.
Okay. So, and you're saying the reason, just clarify for me your reasoning.
Because the ability to make moral decisions requires both options to be viable.
Right. I don't think the question precludes both options being viable. Right.
So are you using the word capacity in the same sense? When you say capacity, do you mean mental capacity or legal capacity?
I mean mental capacity.
Okay.
That mental capacity, I'm not going to get into the legal issues here, but the mental capacity is connected to the legal capacity, quite frankly.
So the question you're asking is, can we not? David's saying that he thinks that if we won't recognize his negative choice, then there's no meaning to our recognition of his positive choice. And the question you're asking is, can we understand that it might be that that it matters or it's legitimate for a person to say yes and to say that yes has meaning, but nonetheless, a no would not have meaning coming from the same person.
Right.
As a psychological evaluation.
Not as a psychological evaluation, no.
As an
evaluation of their ability to make a rational decision. Or, I mean, rational is not the best word there, but as their ability to make a decision in which we have confidence that they have that mental capacity.
So I think they have a lot of having trouble grasping the question, so this is very useful. So one is it possible to be a situation where we'll say that if you said yes, we would believe you that you meant that was something meaningful, that you're making a lucid, calm, rational, capacity statement, but if you say no, that by itself is evident. So we ask the question, we really want you to make a choice, but we're saying up front that if you make the wrong choice, we judge you incompetent.
Exactly.
Impossible situation.
Okay, then you've been waiting to speak for a while, so I apologize.
Ken, this question is just because I don't maybe just me and my lack of medical background, but I feel like I'd like to know more information on this particular case. If you had the transplant, how dangerous is this procedure? What's the likelihood it will come out okay?
The details, to be honest with you, in terms of the actual medical facts to be able to respond to that, but you can assume that, I think it's very reasonable to, I can't give you specific percentages or numbers, but it's very reasonable to assume that first of all, any procedure like this carries a high risk, okay? It's a high risk procedure, just the surgery itself.
Is there a risk that he comes with a heart attack?
No, you're taking out his heart and you're replacing it with a new one. And so it's not that he would have another heart attack during the procedure. He's actually already had bypass.
Due to the stress of going into surgery,
I don't know that you want to get into all the medical stuff, but he already underwent, what causes a heart attack is a blockage of your arteries. And so he already underwent but as a result of that blockage of the arteries, the heart can be damaged. The heart is a muscle, and the heart can be damaged in such a way that it doesn't function in the way that it normally would function, and it doesn't function effectively. So when it gets to the point where it's not functioning at a reasonable capacity, then someone needs a heart transplant. Okay, so sometimes a heart attack or multiple heart attacks or severe heart attacks can lead to someone needing a heart transplant. There are many other reasons why patients need heart transplants too, okay? But he actually already had a bypass procedure so that his arteries are presumably no longer clogged. So he's not going to have, it's unlikely for someone like that to have another heart attack, at least shortly after that kind of procedure. You know, over many years, then their arteries get clogged again and they're at risk for having another heart attack, but not during the transplant procedure.
Are there other medical options? And
okay, so good question. At the time of this case, I'm not sure that there were a lot of other medical options. Now we actually have some pretty good options. At the time, I think it was probably a death sentence, okay? Right now, there's something called a left ventricular assist device, or LVAD, and that's a device that is actually inserted into the patient's heart, basically, and they walk around with a machine that they're attached to. And it used to be the patients were connected to this left ventricular assist device as a bridge to them getting a transplant. So because people were on waiting lists for so long and there weren't enough organs, they would have this left ventricular assist device put in until they could get their heart transplant. Because there's so few hearts, now people are actually, and these machines have actually gotten better, we're now at a point where people are actually using these not as a bridge to transplant, but as something we call destination therapy, where they can stay on them. But people still can't. It's not like you can stay on that for 5-10 years, right? So I think the longest now that we have people out on these things is a year or two.
Okay, so
it's still not, it's not, there isn't, you know, it's not like dialysis. Yes?
First of all, just a medical question. The thing you just mentioned, the left ventricular assist, is that basically the same thing as a pacemaker?
No, it's not at all like a pacemaker.
Okay?
A pacemaker has to do with the electrical activity in a heart. it doesn't deal with the pumping activity of the heart.
Okay, but the other thing, I don't know if anyone mentioned this earlier, One of the issues in terms of his consent is it seems like the doctor's already made the decision before he even had
consented.
Yeah, because he'd already...
He
was already on the list.
No, he hadn't consented yet.
I was
going to
say,
when they went to talk to
the
patients, some doctors in another hospital were already getting the heart for this patient.
Right.
Okay, so you're raising a good point. So what do we mean by informed consent? Let's just go back.
Sign a paper? That seems like a relevant thing. So wait,
okay.
He signed a paper that went on a list, but and then later he went back on it. But if he already had a contract, that would stand up in court. If he then decided, oh, maybe I don't want to, he would probably have to rewrite a contract.
Okay, so...
He would have huge legal room.
So let's just take a question a minute. Let's just take a step back here and talk about what you mean by informed consent. And you're raising a... I'm sorry, I can't remember who was talking to you. Who was just talking to you? No, after you, someone else was talking about signing paper. Okay, tell me your name again, Jeff.
Janice.
Okay, so Janice was talking about this idea of whether or not he signed a form. Okay, so when we talk about informed consent, I want to make sure that you guys understand what we mean by informed consent, what constitutes informed consent. But I think it's also important to understand that there's a distinction between informed consent as a concept, okay, and what underlies the concept of informed consent is the philosophical principle, really, of respect for persons or respect for patient autonomy. So it's the idea that a patient gives their permission to a physician or to anybody to do a procedure, right? Or to and usually, I think it's interesting to note, we don't really get informed consent for therapy. It's really much more focused on procedures, okay? That idea of informed consent as a concept, which has a philosophical underpinning in this concept of respect for persons or respect for autonomy, and does everybody know what autonomy means? Have you talked about that? So autonomy in terms of a person's right to make decisions for themselves, or a right to self-determination, is distinguished from the idea of informed consent as a rule. And what I mean by that is we have this rule in medicine that you have to get patients to sign a form, a consent form. And that consent form usually has information about the risks of the procedure, the benefits of the procedure, right? So what's the likelihood of my dying? Is there a risk of death? What are the alternatives to this procedure? Is an LVAD a reasonable alternative? And then to document that the patient actually agreed to the procedure. So there's this idea of informed consent as a form, and then there's also the concept. What I think is most important, actually, is to recognize that actually informed consent is really a process. Okay, it's not about signing a form, and it's certainly the underlying that process is still this concept of patient autonomy, but the process is a conversation with the patient about what this procedure entails and what it means. It's not just giving them a form that has all that information on it and asking them to sign it. It's making sure that they really understand what's entailed in this procedure that you're asking them to do. Okay? So the fact that, if you go back to the case, the fact that he's refusing, you mentioned that it seems like they already made up their mind and that the physician's already made up their mind. And that what I think it's important to recognize here is that there's probably, I can say with certainty, there are multiple conversations that were had with this patient prior to this point, right? And the signing of the form is really just the culmination of that process. So it's important to recognize that, and even if someone did sign a form already, right? So sometimes patients are consented for a procedure in advance of the surgery, right? It's not like you just come in some cases you don't You don't just come into the hospital and right before the surgery you have the consent form. If you know you're going to be getting a transplant, you might actually sign a whole bunch of consent forms before even coming to the hospital for that. So it's, but a person can still obviously change their mind at any time. Even if you sign the form, you have the, it goes back to this fundamental idea that patients have the right to make decisions for themselves, and they can refuse that at any point in time. Okay? Yes?
Why is the anesthetist one who explains it? And if they have the consent form, why do they need to ask again?
So it's an interesting question because when you have surgery, right, you have the surgeon that does the surgery with all the other people that help them, and then you have the anesthesiologist, the person that's putting the patient to sleep. And there's a separate consent for the anesthesia and for the surgery. There are two different consent processes. So it's not uncommon for the patient to have actually already given consent to the surgery in advance. And then but they only meet the anesthesiologist the minute, like right before the surgery, when they're at the hospital that day. So it's at that point that they're first meeting the anesthesiologist, and that's when the anesthesiologist is getting consent. So in some cases, that's actually kind of interesting because there's always conflict between anesthesiologists and surgeons, because the anesthesiologist may actually present the risks of the surgery differently than the surgeon will. And that may cause a patient to rethink and reconsider whether or not they want to continue with the surgery. Okay? Yes?
What David said before about cancer rather capacity, not their autonomy is a value, and there's also a value of saving the patient's life or saving the patient's kidneys or whatever. Now, the question is, you know, which values might override other values. You might have that value of autonomy until that person says, I want to die right now, in which case he's just lost his value, you know, in which case the quest to save his life perhaps overrides that value. And we just have informed consent. It's just a legal formality now that we have to get out of.
Could you not think of any situation where there's a treatment that you would deem so immoral that it would be that you would rather die than be treated that way?
This treatment clearly by the government is not deemed so immoral. This treatment
the
is...
The government has the right to make morality decisions for me? That is a very scary thought.
Perhaps.
I know what I'm terribly scared of on a political level, and that's the government making
also, it's also not clear to me that to have autonomy, I need to have the two options.
The two options of what?
Two options of getting the heart transplant and not getting the heart, like of dying and staying alive.
What do you mean by autonomy then? If it's not choosing between options,
right? So perhaps it's only the.
If let me just take what you're saying a little bit further. If
sure.
A physician is going to be what we would say contrast with this concept or principle of autonomy. Is the principle or concept of paternalism,
right?
Okay, which means that someone else is acting like a parent or making decisions on behalf of a patient. Okay,
right.
In probably about 50 years ago, that's the way most medical decisions were made.
Right.
Physicians would, for the most part, tell patients what to do and make decisions on their behalf.
Right.
And actually, in many parts of the world today, paternalism is a much more prevalent approach to medical decision making than it is in the United States. And I would say even in Israel, physicians are much, much more paternalistic in the way they approach decision making. There is less involvement of patients' preferences and less respect for patient autonomy, which I think is actually, in some cases, an outgrowth of a halachic perspective, quite frankly. It's a very interesting article written in the New England Journal of Medicine, probably about 10 years ago, I don't know if already you've seen it, but a friend of mine, colleague Shimon Glick, who's a physician at Beer Sheva, an American physician who made Aliyah a long time ago, and has been at Ben-Gurion University, and he wrote an article about an Israeli understanding of autonomy, and in particular in the context of hunger strikers, and whether or not we should respect a hunger striker's autonomy, and how basically in Israel they do not respect the hunger striker's autonomy, and went on to talk about why. And so it's an interesting thing if people are interested. You can get it online and read it. But I think that if you're if we value autonomy, and if we, the concept of informed consent is predicated on the idea that you have to give patients alternatives, right? So they do have to be aware of those two options, at least.
Right. At some point, we do. At some point, we do make a some sort of like cultural, moral, ethic, you know, a decision as to which patient we consider able to make the decision and which patient we don't.
Good.
So perhaps one, perhaps you know, perhaps our system sees a patient who decides to die as actually incapable of making a decision, which is just I think it's just an outgrowth. It exhibits that fact that we value saving life over that autonomy in reality, but it's still. And these are just definitions of when we decide someone's irrational or rational, or able to make decisions or unable to make decisions.
Okay, so let's take a step back. You're raising some really good points. Based on your conversation last week, what are the elements of informed consent? Okay.
An appreciation of the patient's condition, of the risks and benefits of all the different given procedures, so that they may make an informed choice about what they would like to do. That's, I think, how it was defined for us.
There's the five things that the physicians refer to.
Yeah, there was a list.
Disclose.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
So those are inform the patient of the nature of this condition, inform the patient of the nature and purpose of the treatment, disclose the risks of the proposed treatment, disclose the benefits of the proposed treatment, and disclose alternatives along with the risks and benefits.
Okay, so that's sort of what I said before in terms of, right? Pretty much what you just described. That's sort of the idea that the consent form has to have information about what the treatment is, risks, benefits, and alternatives. Anything else in terms of what constitutes informed consent? What else do you need? What do you need in order for you to feel confident that from an ethical perspective you actually have done, you have engaged in the process of obtaining informed consent in an ethically legitimate manner? That you feel confident that you've really done what you're supposed to do in terms of the communication with the patient about the procedure that they're about to undergo?
Does the patient understand what you told them?
Good. Okay, so that's a different issue than the content, right? So one issue is information or content, right? Another issue is understanding. Okay, anything else?
Yeah, we listed four exceptions to informed consent.
Okay, so let's leave the exceptions out for now. And just focus on what do you need to make informed consent ethically, what I would consider to be ethically valid. Yes?
So one thing to be considered, apparently this is still kind of something that's getting worked out today, is about informed consent about the physician themselves. About the experience the physician has, the success rate, these sorts of things.
Okay, so you're talking about some disclosure?
Yeah.
Is that maybe? And disclosure can be a lot of different things. It can be disclosure of information, and what you're saying is, well, maybe it should also include disclosure about success and
right.
Things like that. It's an interesting idea, actually. And in practice, whereas I think that medically savvy patients will ask those questions, it has not become the norm at the current time to include that in the informed consent process, unless patients ask.
Well, the question is, even if they do ask, does the doctor have to answer truthfully? And that's
right.
The question still being decided.
I don't think there's any question about that, actually. Who's deciding?
It's the courts.
Tell me where you see that's an open question. No, I'm serious.
I think Dr. Applebaum did say they don't have to answer why.
Right.
The question is, do they have to answer the question at all?
Right.
Or they could just say,
so first of all, really important concept here. When you are approaching issues in medical ethics, from my perspective, as an ethicist, you should not be thinking about it from a legal perspective. Okay? You should not be thinking, what does the law allow me to do or not allow me to do? Because that is not necessarily what is ethical. Okay? And there are many cases where what the law says is ethical, or is, I would say, legal or acceptable, and the implication there is that it's ethical, is not what I think that we would most people would say is necessarily ethical. In other words, there can be a conflict between what the law in a secular society, now maybe in a halakhic context you would say that shouldn't exist, although I would hope you would still be thinking independently in terms of your own mind about whether or not something is ethical, whether or not something is right, whether or not our American legal system says that it is legally acceptable, or whether or not the halakhic system says it's legally, it is acceptable. So just because excuse my heresy maybe here, but I would hope that if the halakhic system says that something is absolutely ethically or absolutely halakhically mutter, that your inclination is that there's something really fundamentally wrong with this, that you would give that serious consideration and thought. Because actually the whole issue of truth-telling is a very interesting one to be thinking about, both from a secular perspective as well as a halakhic perspective. And there may be many cases in which halakha may say you can lie, because maybe that there's a presumption that it's going to protect the patient, actually. But so be careful about conflating what other people consider to be ethically acceptable or legitimate or justified with what is legally okay. Okay? Yes.
Yeah, so as a general question, I mean, it seems that historically the reason why we moved to this model of autonomy and informed consent is not necessarily because we have this overarching philosophical notion that autonomy is the best way for things to work, but it's just that there have been cases where things have gone wrong and the doctor did something to the patient that, in retrospect, the patient really, really, really would not have wanted because there might have been other options. So I'm wondering that instead of looking at this broad model of autonomy, maybe you can say that informed consent should really only apply to situations where there are multiple legitimate options for treatment, and there's a possibility that objectively we can't tell what's best for the patient unless the patient makes a decision. But in certain situations, such as this situation, where it's the patient is going to die if you don't do the treatment, then you shouldn't even bother with consent, because your first interest is to do what's objectively best for the patient. But if within that we can't tell what's objectively best for the patient unless we ask him, so then we're going to go and do that.
Okay, so that's a very, very interesting suggestion. The second case that I have, which I don't think we're going to have time to get to, in some ways raises that point, in that it's a case that it's really not a question of sort of significant harm to the patient that might happen if you do or do not do the procedure. But my concern about what you said is that there's something very presumptuous on our part as physicians if we were to limit, or if we were to decide that we don't need informed consent in this situation, but we need it in that, we don't need it in this case, but we need it in that case. And let's say we have good reasons for that, like you said, because we want to save the life of a person. We don't know. There's huge variability in patients' reasons for wanting medical care or not wanting medical care, in patients' values, whether they value quality of life or quantity of life. And saving a life may not, from the patient's perspective, always be the most important thing from their perspective. Right? If you can save my life, but I'm not going to be able to communicate in any meaningful way with my family, I may decide I'm not interested in that life. Now, I'm not talking about this from a halakhic perspective, but from a secular medical ethics perspective, that's certainly a legitimate response. So my concern with what you just suggested, which is interesting, is that it presumes an imposition of the physician's values or the medical culture's values on patients because you're limiting their options. You're making an assumption about what they would want. And I think you're right in terms of historically where how we got here because of a whole bunch of bad things happening to patients. But I think there's also, it's important to not only go back to that historical experience and be aware of it, I mean, I think also, you know, even when you think about the whole concept, actually, of informed consent is also an outgrowth of Nuremberg and what happened to what the Nazi doctors did in Germany without the consent of the people. So I think that the philosophical, it's important not to forget the philosophical concept that underlies informed consent and to ask yourselves, well, do I really respect this person's right to make a decision, him or herself? And if that's a value that you have, then it seems to me it's a responsibility to make sure that that we do give them options. Okay? So there's a lot of questions here, and I want to make sure that we get to more a better understanding of what we mean by informed consent. But so go ahead, and then. Yeah.
I just
wanted
to ask you a question about what you had mentioned before about if there was a possibility where a person can consent for something but not
right.
Refuse. And I want to know how far we would potentially extend that in the sense of that in this case here, where presumably if he had consented, they would have gone forward.
That's a good question. So I want to leave that because I think in order to answer that question, really, I've made some assumptions in my mind about what you guys had covered last week, I think, and in terms of really understanding what we mean by an ethically valid informed consent. So I think in order to answer that question, you really need to grasp what we mean by an ethically, what I would consider to be an ethically valid informed consent.
So I think you mentioned Nuremberg, which is very key for me, and I think all of us would agree that, you know, the Nazis developing any medical treatment that involved killing of Jews is immoral treatment, and I think in order to preserve my absolute right to refuse that treatment, it is an absolute necessity that I respect anyone's right to refuse treatment on any moral ground.
Right. Good. And
even
basically,
one I might personally disagree with.
Absolutely. And so that is fundamentally the situation in American society, where the whole principle of patient autonomy allows anybody to refuse any adult with mental capacity can refuse any treatment, even if it is life-sustaining. Okay, so that goes back to your question.
So refusal of treatment per se cannot be evidence of incapacity.
That's absolutely correct. Right? I think that's an important point. And so that takes us back to our case in terms of what was going on here, and was the refusal of treatment being understood as lack of capacity. So let's just take a step back first for a second. I want to just come back to the point that you made earlier, because I feel like I didn't bring as much closure to it as I would have liked to, and this idea of whether doctors have to respond to patients' questions about their success or, you know, their outcomes. Right? There's a huge focus now on outcomes in medicine, and you know, we know there's a relationship between the volume of procedures that a physician does or that a surgeon does, and the outcomes, the quality of the outcomes that ensue. So it's a very reasonable question for a patient to ask, how many heart transplants have you done, and what is your success rate? You know, how many of your patients are alive at 5 years? Or how many patients died within the first 30 days? And those kinds of questions strike me as being part of disclosure, or also part of, you know, the element of disclosure of information, not disclosure of only personal information about the physician, but when a patient is asking questions about a procedure that are very relevant to their decision-making process, I think that the physician absolutely has an obligation to answer those questions, and that's a fundamental part of the informed consent process. Okay? legally, whether the physician has to be honest about it, I don't know. And I don't care, to be honest with you, because my goal is to ensure that the physicians that I'm training are doing this with integrity and with in a way that I can ensure it has patients' best interests at heart.
So how do you balance all the issues of informed consent, things like the Hippocratic Oath, and also not giving an assisted suicide in places where that might come into play? So, I feel like there's a lot of gray area in how to balance those, because would it be considered an assisted suicide if you don't give this guy a transplant? Then is it really a decision that he can make?
Okay, so I don't want to get into a whole conversation about physician-assisted suicide, but the short answer is that it would not be considered assisted suicide. Okay, and what we mean by assisted suicide, what we mean by assisted suicide is giving patients a means, providing patients with typically a medication that they can then use to die when they decide that they want to die. So what we mean by assisted suicide, and assisted suicide is now legal, I think, in two states in the United States, in Oregon and I think Washington recently, and actually in several other countries also, like Belgium, it's legal, and a couple other, in the Netherlands, obviously. And what we mean by assisted suicide is whether or not it is ethically okay for the physician to prescribe a lethal amount of medication that the patient can then take when they decide that they want to die. So a patient that has terminal cancer that wants to be in control of their death and is afraid that they're not going to be able to control their death, is it okay for the physician to prescribe a large amount of pills that the patient can then take? That's distinguished from euthanasia, okay, in which the physician actually injects the patient with a lethal dose of medication that results in their death and kills them.
There's also passive. Why would this not be a passive form of euthanasia?
This is not euthanasia at all. This is not euthanasia.
They're not teaming up. It's
okay.
Not two people on the same.
The patient is refusing treatment.
Yeah.
So that's the question. So if he's refusing treatment, even if it's said to be concrete that he will die if he refuses this treatment, then either you say that he has a right to do it and the physician shouldn't have meddled with the...
I didn't say that. I mean, I said that he has a right to refuse. I said in general, adult competent patients have the right to refuse.
We talked about, last week we talked about the case of Dr. Applebaum about a woman who had gangrene.
Yes.
And she refused to
have the amputation, right.
And she lived for 7 years or something. Mm-hmm. And there was, the doctors presented it as objectively, if she didn't have it, she would die.
Right.
Right. So where do you draw the line in these situations?
Well, so you're right. So you're pointing to the fact that, doctors are not prophets. Doctors can't predict with certainty when a person is going to die or not die. And so the fact that a doctor may say that someone is going to die without it doesn't mean that they absolutely will. And so we need to have much more humility about our predictions and the prognosis that we give patients. But that's an important point, I think. But I think just to go back to your original question, it's important in your own mind to distinguish a patient's refusal of treatment and refusal of life-sustaining treatment from physician-assisted suicide. The physician is not assisting in the death of the patient. The physician is not preventing the death of the patient, but the physician is not also assisting in that death.
But then we have the issue of the Hippocratic Oath and the doctor's, promise to do everything best for the patient. Then how does that then reconcile?
So I think that reconciles by our reliance on and our belief in the value of patient autonomy and a consensus within our society that patients actually want physicians to respect their wishes and that patients are usually the best judge of what's best for them. Assuming that they have all the... assuming a variety of things, which we haven't really gotten to yet. So let's just come back for a second and make sure that we get to these things because they're really quite fundamental. So one thing is disclosure. And we talked about disclosure of information and disclosure of statistics, maybe, in terms of outcomes and things like that. Do you guys talk about different standards of disclosure, right? Because last week at all? So when we talk about
reasonable position versus reasonable patient, versus reasonable patient.
Okay, so well, there's well, you can say there's a what I would call a professional practice standard. Okay, which is what would most physicians. It's not reasonable physician. It's what would what would most physicians disclose to this patient? And maybe that gets back to the question that was raised earlier. What would most physicians automatically disclose their outcomes? I think most physicians would probably not disclose their outcomes unless asked. But if asked, they would certainly respond. So what would be the professional practice standard? The other concept, the other standard of disclosure would be the reasonable person standard. So what would most reasonable people want? Now, maybe we've evolved in our in our society in terms of our understanding of what Rob said in terms of maybe most people really want now that kind of outcomes data. So the reasonable person would want that, and maybe we should say our reasonable person standard should actually include that. And then the third possibility is actually a subjective person standard, which is sort of on some lines, what you were saying earlier is that, well, maybe if we really knew our patient, and let's say we had a patient who we knew valued sanctity of life and quantity of life no matter what, that what we would disclose to that patient in an informed consent process would be different than what we would disclose under the reasonable person standard. So it's much more subjective. It's related to this individual patient. And I think most people say, well, that's not... The current practice is somewhere in between the professional practice standard and the reasonable person standard. So the norm in terms of what we have to disclose is based on what we think most reasonable people would want to know and what we think most physicians would actually disclose in this setting. Okay?
The whole active-passive distinction strikes me as a legal distinction with no ethical basis. I don't see the difference between taking a passive course of action, which I know will lead to the patient's death, and actively euthanizing them.
So we're not. So I think you're absolutely right from a philosophical consequentialist perspective in terms of the outcomes of both of those actions. The consequences are the same, and from a philosophical perspective, most people would say there is actually no significant moral distinction between those two. We're not going to talk today about active and passive euthanasia or. You know, I mean, halakhically, it's a very common concept, right? The difference between a sheva, valtasa,
sure.
And...
Sure. Legally, it makes some sense. But like you said before, put aside the legalisms, we're talking just about ethics here.
I mean, the train problem is totally ethical.
That concept of active versus passive has entered into the ethical literature there's been a lot of conversation and writing about that in end-of-life care. Okay, but it's really not relevant to what we're talking about today. So what we're talking about today is informed consent and... With that, you know, really using this example of the refusal of treatment, but it's really focused on informed consent. So you have to ask.
I think it is related because I think they're one and the same issue. And that if I think active euthanasia is unethical, then I should also think that it's unethical to listen to the patient's wishes when they want to end their life any way.
There's some fundamental mistake in the thinking that's similar to what was being said earlier. I'm sorry, I don't know your name. Deirdre. So you're saying, I don't think you should be thinking about a patient refusing life-sustaining treatment as passive euthanasia.
I don't see why not.
It may be from the because when we talk about euthanasia, we're talking about a physician's involvement. Okay, it may be from the patient's perspective, passive suicide. Okay. But from a physician's perspective, the physician is not doing anything to hasten that patient's death or doing anything to assist in that patient's death.
But if I'm not doing everything I can to extend their life, I don't see the ethical distinction.
From an ethical perspective, you don't have any obligation to save a person's life where they don't want you to save their life, to intervene where they don't want you to intervene.
I mean, I agree, but I think the logical consequence is that you also have a right to end their life if they want you to.
That's a different conversation. There can be a whole bunch of
reasons. Comfortable with saying, but let's actually say that then.
Well, I mean, I'm not necessarily willing to say that, to be honest with you, because I think there can be a whole other set of reasons why you would say that that's not acceptable ethically. Okay. You might be able to come to that conclusion, but the question then is, are there other reasons that mitigate against it? But I don't want to take us there, because it's really a different topic. Yes, well,
I just want to kind of, you only get these conclusions, David, if you're a super consequentialist. Like, if you only really care about the end result, but there's other things also involved inside the end result.
Well, I care about intentions. But, alright.
Okay, yes.
I think one of the reasons why we're getting into this confusion is because I'm not sure halakha distinguishes between the agency of the patient and the agency of the doctor in the same way that medical ethics does. I think that the strength of the prohibition of suicide being so much higher than it is in secular ethics makes it so that for us that those two issues are one and the same, and from the perspective of medical ethics, those are very different issues.
Right, I think you're right, Andrew. I think that your suggestion, tell me your name again.
My name?
Yeah.
Tobia.
The suggestion that Tobia had earlier may actually be something that is workable within a halakhic context, but
right.
I think it's not workable within a secular
right.
medical
for
ethics. I think that's a really good question. Let's come back to what do we mean by ethically valid informed consent. So far we have disclosure, you need a certain amount of information. We have understanding, but we haven't really talked a little bit about what that means. And I think what I would sort of say is understanding is really the way in which we would frame that in a medical ethics context is much more the idea of capacity. Does this person have capacity? And what we mean by that is, what do we mean by that? I mean, what do we mean when we say, does the patient have capacity?
So maybe understand the information on the theoretical level and then apply it to his own set of values and his own ethics. He has to be able to not just synthesize information, but also apply it to his own
good
wills and desires.
Excellent. So I think that's a really important thing. It's a matter of being able to reason about the questions at hand. Okay, it's about synthesizing the information, and that's an important process, right? People have to really understand the fundamentals of the information. They have to understand the havamim is, right? They have to understand what are the implications of the different alternatives that they have before them. But they also then have to be able to reason about those different options. They have to be able, which goes back to Tobia's really initial question, well, why did this patient refuse the transplant? That's a critically important question, because we, as physicians, in order to assess whether or not the informed consent was actually valid, in order to assess whether or not this patient actually had the capacity to make the decision, we need to understand their reasons. It's not whether they're rational. It's not whether we agree with the decision that they arrive at. It's not about their decision. It's not about the fact that they decided to refuse a life-sustaining treatment, but it's how they got to that decision. Why did they get to that decision? Do they have insight into the consequences of that decision?
And why exactly do we care how they got to the decision? If someone's completely lucid and we've told, if someone's really, if the assumption of this question is that they have to justify themselves to us to say no. If the assumption of informed consent is that the patients have autonomy, unless they've put themselves in unless they've have a prior reason that they've committed, to having, any given procedure to the point where, right, any reneging on that is assumed to be faulty unless you can justify your way out of it. Right, there's no, if the assumption is autonomy, right, why do we have to understand it? It sounds like we're trying to justify it to the doctors. There's no particular reason why that should be true.
No, there is. So this is, I think, a really excellent question, and it's important to recognize that when we say that we respect a patient's autonomy and we respect their preferences, that's qualified, right? There's a qualification there. Our respect is predicated on the assumption that they have the mental capacity to make a decision.
We already said that they do.
No, we have not said that
in
they do. I think that
case,
that's the question that this...
In this case, we did.
We absolutely did not. We said that the person's lucid. Okay, so maybe this is a matter of sort of having a sensitivity to the complexity of patients' clinical situations. Does anybody have any experience with people with dementia? relatives with dementia. Okay, and at the in the early stages of dementia, okay, dementia is a neurological disease that is a huge spectrum, right? From people initially maybe having some problems with memory and to getting to the point where it's advanced and they're bedbound and don't recognize anybody, can't feed themselves, can't eat, right? So there's this huge spectrum of dementia. We don't really, you know, we're not very good at, we don't have any good treatment for it or any way to prevent it, really. But there are patients that can be mildly demented where they appear to be lucid. And you can have a conversation with them. And they may be very pleasant, and it seems like they know what they're talking about. But then when you try and reason with them, and you try and probe a little bit deeper into their understanding, into their insight into a particular issue, you can't go there. They are incapable of having that kind of conversation. They're incapable of synthesizing information and reasoning about information. Okay, so when we talk about the fact, does not at all mean that the patient has the mental capacity to make a decision. And it
describes the case to the doctor, and the doctor says, if he doesn't choose, you know, to do such and such procedure, he's going to die. The exact same case, just
right.
He hasn't yet put himself in the position of being a patient. Right? Are the same criteria going to apply? Are we going to say, well, right, I have the right not just to, once he's already in